Our speaker tonight does not need introduction to most of you sitting in here because you know him. I've known this guy ever since he came into the program. And you talk about growth, I have seen a tremendous growth. He is very, very active in the Alumni Association. He does a lot of service work. He's just got a really, appears to have a really good solid grip on his program of sobriety. And he has just become my best friend because he showed me a picture of a 55-foot yacht that he's just bought. So, let's welcome John Pingree.
Good evening, everybody. I'm John, and I am powerless over alcohol.
John.
I'm also powerless over people, places, and things, and that's something I have to work on every day. I'm here to try to share my experience, strength, and hope with all of you. My story also includes some time that I tried to work this program my way and not the way that it's laid out. And it doesn't work because I'll tell you, my sobriety date is April 29th of 2008. I first came into the program of AA for myself, not for another family member, in 1998. So you can do the math. For about 10 years, I kept trying to do it my way, and for 10 years, I stayed miserable and finally had to surrender and accept the fact. But so that's part of you know, my story. But I was born in New England. I lived in a small rural suburb of Boston. And I have a younger brother, a year younger than I am, and a sister that's 3 years younger than I am. Was raised on a horse farm up there. Went to a private school. And my parents, you know, were good parents. We were Episcopalian, I guess. We went to church most Sundays, you know, and us kids, we'd go off to Sunday school while the parents, you know, had cigarettes and coffee in the fellowship room. And so, you know, that was the way it is. And I always loved the term that Episcopalian is just one step down from full-blown Catholic. I don't know, but whatever. So I was raised with a belief in God, and I guess you might say I also felt like God was an all-seeing, all-knowing, and punishing God. But I found, working this program, that He's not. He is a loving God, and He'll do anything. If you'll do some work, He'll work with you. My parents were... My dad was raised in a family where children were meant to be seen and not heard. And so when I grew up, you know, Mom would feed the three of us. We'd be in the kitchen. She'd feed us dinner, and then she and Dad would retire to the den and watch the news and have cocktails. That was an every night thing. I didn't know much about alcohol. It's just that's the way I was raised. When I was 12 years old, my parents got divorced, and my father almost immediately remarried. He had been seeing this woman for a while, and she had three kids. So I kiddingly say that we became the Brady Bunch because she had three and my dad had three, except we didn't live together. My brother and I stayed with my mom. And so we moved out of the house that my father had built, that I spent most of my childhood years growing up there in that house, and all of a sudden had to move at age 12 to my dad bought us another house in the neighboring town. And I didn't think much of it then, but I'll never forget the time that before my my dad and stepmom had moved back into the house, that my stepmom was showing a friend of hers that came by the house to see it, where she was going to be living, and she's showing them all the different rooms, and she goes down to my bedroom and tells her friend, this is going to be Steve's bedroom. That was my stepbrother. And I'm thinking, no, that's my bedroom. But, you know, it is what it is. So we moved to a neighboring town and actually saw very little of my father. He'd see us every now and then. We'd come over and we'd have playtime and stuff like that. But after a couple of years, my mom realized that that just wasn't working. And so she grew up in a small town between Huntsville and Nashville. And so she said, you know, maybe the kid's dad would see more of him if I moved him 1,000 miles away, because then he'd be required by, you know, the child support and divorce decree to see us. So that's what we did. Is mom didn't want to take us back to a little sleepy southern town, so we moved to Huntsville, which was really is a good town. I loved Huntsville. It was a small enough town, but it was very much advanced in the space program and everything else. And that's one of the things I loved. Ever since I was a little boy, I've loved airplanes and rockets. We used to do model rockets and model airplanes and stuff like that. But so we moved to Huntsville, Alabama when I was 14 years old. And talk about a cultural shock. I went from a private school in the suburbs of Boston to public schools in Huntsville, Alabama. And this was the very early 70s, and I tended to wear my hair longer. All the guys up there in Massachusetts wore their hair a little bit longer. So when I first got down to 8th grade junior high in Huntsville, I was almost immediately put into a clique referred to as the hippies. And I didn't know what cliques were. We didn't have those in the small school that I was in Massachusetts. But basically there were three cliques. There were the jocks, the athletes, the football players. There was the hippies, those that had long hair and, you know, smoked pot and all that other stuff. And then the nerds or whatever. But so of no part of my own, I was automatically, you know, segregated into the clique of hippies because of the length of my hair. And I got a lot of teasing and stuff like that from the other kids. And my brother and I liked fourth grade so much when we were living in Massachusetts that I got to do that twice. So from fourth grade, second time, all the way through high school and graduation, my brother and I were in the same grade together. And that sometimes put us in the same classes together. But so here we are. And it's funny because after a year or so, the hairstyles, everybody, all the males had long hair, including the football players. But yet, in certain classes, I would get rubber bands thrown in or gum in my hair because, you know, they thought that was funny. I didn't think it was so funny. And I got myself in trouble in eighth grade for that. But so here I am, classified as a hippie. And plus, you could get a motorcycle license at age 15 in Alabama. And I drove a motorcycle to eighth grade. And so did several other people. I mean, several other guys. And most of them had long hair, too. But so got in trouble because of the fact that, you know, I was constantly being teased, and I got tired of it, and I got suspended because I thought, you know, we were going to have a fight or something. And a whole bunch of us showed up to school one day with something of a weapon, if you will. I had a knife in a sheath inside my boot, and sure enough, I got called out of class and all. So my transition from New England to North Alabama was a little bit hectic, but at that time I had never taken a drink. I had never smoked pot, And then I got into high school, and like I said, my brother's a year younger than me. And I remember one day, he came home and he turns to me and he says, "Hey, John, guess what I did today?" And I'm thinking, "Well, I don't know, did you go buy a CB radio?" And he says, "No, I smoked pot." And I thought, wait a second, I'm older than you, and you did this first? So I had to go remedy that real quick. So I ended up smoking pot in high school, and then I'll never forget the first time I took a drink of beer. I did not like it. I thought, this is ridiculous. But, you know, at that time I didn't have a problem with it, and so I was doing what my friends were doing, the normal things that, you know, kids 15, 16, 17 year olds, you know, we partied after school and stuff like that. But so I ended up getting through high school, and at that time I did not plan to go to college. I had no desire to go to college. I actually, for my junior, senior year, I took auto mechanics at trade school. And that's what I planned to do. And I ended up working in a garage, working in a service station for a couple of years. And I ended up working at a Sears Auto Center for a couple of years. And I really thought that's what I was going to do. But I had always had a love of airplanes. And I had even actually one time gone out and taken one of these introductory lessons at the local airport, where you paid $10 or whatever and you got to go up in an airplane for about an hour. And then immediately wrecked my car after that. I mean, you know, a couple weeks later. So that sort of, you know, flying had to be put on the back burner, although it was always still a love of mine. And after I graduated, my mom and I were talking. What she was going to get me as a graduation present was a big roll-around toolbox, a Craftsman toolbox full of tools, because that's what I really thought I needed and wanted. And we were watching a TV show on little airplanes and stuff like that. It was a series called Spencer's Pilots. And she turned to me and says, "Well, have you ever thought about maybe going back and trying to take flying lessons again?" And this was right after I'd graduated high school. And I said, "Yeah, I think possibly that might be fun." So I started taking flying lessons. And I was working at the Sears Auto Center and taking flying lessons. And like I said, had no thoughts of ever going to college until I found out that there were actually aviation-related colleges around the country. And my dad knew people up in New England that were associated with some of the airports up there, and they told my father that I should look into an aviation college in St. Louis. And so I did, and I thought, well, this would be cool. I could go to college and I would still be flying and stuff like that. So I decided maybe I'll apply to go, you know, to this aviation school. Maybe it'd be more fun than just being an auto mechanic for the rest of my life. And so that's what I did. I applied, and because I had trouble with math in high school, I had a deficiency in algebra. So they said, "You're going to have to take a course in algebra at a community college, and then we'll reevaluate your application." So that's what I ended up doing, is I went to a community college, took a class in algebra, did fine, got accepted to this aviation school, and I started at the school a year after I graduated high school. Before I started at the school, and this is, you know, I'm still partying with my friends, you know, Fridays and, well, wasn't just Fridays and Saturdays, you know, we'd smoke pot and drink beer and stuff like that. But that's one of the things that I held on to, is the requirement set forth by the FAA that says you wait 8 hours between throttle and bottle, which means you don't drink at least eight hours. And so I never did. I mean, so I never even thought about flying an airplane or taking a lesson or anything that, you know, where I was not fully aware of my, you know, condition and all of that. So I never did I never did take any mind-altering substance and then go flying, because I held that very high. But so I ended up going and visiting this school a couple months before I started. My mom and I drove to St. Louis to see it, and I remember my mom got up to go use the ladies' room at one point, and the lady who we were talking with leans over the desk and says, "This is not a party school. We take our academics here very seriously. Just want you to know that." And I'm thinking, oh, shit, there goes, you know, there goes partying and all that. And then as it turns out, when I actually showed up 2 months later with all my, you know, stuff to and was moving into the dorm, I remember being approached by a guy at the, you know, the door, and he says, you got any beer or pot? And I said, no. And he says, well, here. And he hands me a joint. And I'm thinking, well, I guess that lady in the front office doesn't really know what she's talking about. But so I started at the school in a flying capacity. I was flying and working on getting additional pilot ratings and stuff like that. And then there was a bunch of my friends that I had made there that we realized we could continue doing our flying on the side, but we could also, for the same amount of tuition, earn our airplane mechanics license, which is referred to as an A&P, which means airframe and power plant. And so a bunch of us switched after just one trimester and started working on our A&P licenses and still continued to fly. And so that went on the next few years, and I really enjoyed that. I had a friend that one day he turned to me, we're going to lab while we're working on our A&P and we're carrying a toolbox. And he says, John, do you ever think you'd be in college going to class with a toolbox in your hand? And I said, no, that's not what I ever thought. I always thought it'd be books and all of this. And so I ended up graduating. Well, no, before that, I was getting close to graduation, and I was sort of fast-tracking it because the school was set up on trimesters, and if you, most folks just went two trimesters, which meant you went from August till about April. But if you went through the summer, a third trimester, you could get your four-year degree in just 3 years. And so that's what I had been doing. And so for about 2.5 years, I had been basically going to school steady, straight. And I thought, you know, maybe something would be nice. Lockheed, just up the street, had a training program for frontline supervisors that they went to the three big aviation schools around the country looking for young people to get into a co-op program. A friend of mine down the hall in the dorm had tried it the year before. He said it just wasn't his cup of tea, but he says, you know, John, you might want to just go and practice getting, you know, interviewing. And so I ended up borrowing a tie from somebody just so I could wear a shirt with a tie to this interview. But there was a couple of guys from Lockheed that had come up to St. Louis, and they were interviewing. And there was, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 guys that they interviewed up there that I then got an invitation out of all the other guys they interviewed to come down here to Marietta, Georgia, in the winter of around Thanksgiving of 1979. And so I came down here, and it was another battery of interviews with different managers of the, you know, in the factory. And then they made me an offer, and I said, okay, seven trimesters straight, I need a break. And Marietta is only about 3-hour drive from Huntsville. I said, I might as well try it. If it doesn't work out, you know, what the heck. Well, so I came to work at Lockheed as a co-op in January of 1980. And what I ended up doing is staying for 3 months, went back to school, did another trimester, came back to Lockheed for about 4 months, and then went back to school and graduated in April of 81. And then I was put permanently on the payroll. And it's so funny because then I, you know, thought, well, this is temporary. I may find something different that I may do. And but it, as it turns out, it was the longest temporary job I ever had. I retired from Lockheed after 32 years. So I'm very grateful. And, I mean, I should be grateful because I, you know, was given a second chance by them when I got in trouble with my alcoholism, and I'll get to that. But so that's what I did right after I graduated college in April. I then got married to now my ex-wife, who was from the St. Louis area, and we moved down here. All this time I was drinking, you know, and I quit smoking pot because I now was working for a Department of Defense contractor and subject to random tests. So I thought, you know, I'll quit the pot and I'll just drink because it's legal, you know. And I don't know, maybe I thought it was different, you know, that especially when I work the night shift and I get off at midnight and I'd have to stop at the gas station on Franklin Road and get me two tall boy beers to drink on the 5 miles to the apartment that my new bride and I were sharing. But, you know, hey, I put in a 9-hour day. I felt like I deserved it. So for a while, I just, you know, things seemed normal. But I'll admit, you know, that my drinking, I really got quite a taste for gin and tonics, and I would drink those even, you know, if we were going to go to a party that was, alcohol would be served, I'd have to still get me a drink or two before I left the house, just, you know, to get primed, you know, get ready to go. And so for a longest time that, you know, I didn't think I had a problem. And so, you know, that was just normal, I figured. And my wife drank. She drank wine and, you know. But our first child was born in 88. And that maybe should have been an eye-opener to me because, obviously, my wife had to quit drinking because she was pregnant. And I didn't support her. I didn't quit drinking. I just continued to drink my normal, what I thought was normal. So, I mean, she even asked me, you know, don't you think that maybe you could support me? And I'm thinking, well, maybe. So, well, that would have gotten in the way of my drinking. But so, we ended up having two children, a son, and then about 2.5 years later, we had a daughter. And my mom was one of us. It turns out that there is alcoholism in my mother's family. I did not realize this until she'd been in the program for a while, that I actually had two uncles, one that died of alcohol-related issues, another one that took his own life. And it was also related to alcohol. But so in the mid-80s, my mom was having problems and kind of knew something might be wrong because, you know, when a sweet lady who hardly ever used the F word or anything like that would be talking to my father, her ex, on the phone. And, you know, back then you had wired phones. And she tore the phone right off the kitchen wall. And, you know, there's the bottle of scotch sitting out on the counter that, you know. But so it turned out my mom had an issue with alcohol. And we ended up having to put her in a rehab in Huntsville. Actually put her in twice. Well, I remember my uncle, her brother lived in Huntsville. And so we had an intervention. And so I was exposed to rehabs and the program of AA, but, you know, it maybe made a flickering candle in my the back of my mind that, you know, maybe you drink a little bit more than you should, but I didn't really give it much thought. But as it turns out, my mom ended up moving back to Boston area after my sister had graduated college, because she didn't have a lot of friends in Huntsville, and she had a lot more friends in Boston. So even though she was her father had passed on and her stepmom, so she really didn't have any family except her own brother that was there. My brother lived in Northwest Alabama, Tuscumbia, Florence area, so he wasn't even in Huntsville, and I was here in Marietta, so she didn't have it. And my sister lived in Vermont, so she didn't have any kids near her, so she moved back. And after she had gotten back to Boston area, she ended up, we had to put her in another rehab. Intervention was done, but this time she went to a place in Minneapolis, St. Paul, called St. Mary's. I think it's part of the Hazleton group. And that's the one that actually stuck, because, you know, mom was in and out of rehabs and wasn't getting the program. But so she went to this place in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I remember they had a family week that my brother, sister, and I all went to Minneapolis to support mom. And that's the first time I really ever gone to an AA meeting. But I went to an AA meeting in support of my mom. And I even remember one night I had a laptop computer because I was having to work on something for Lockheed, and my brother and sister were going to go back to we were in a hotel. They went back to the hospital to go to an AA meeting with mom, and I said, no, I need to stay here and work. Well, no, that was my excuse so I could stay there in the hotel room and drink, because I made a choice. I wanted to drink instead of go to an AA meeting to support mom. But it is what it is. Mom ended up passing in 2012, and she had about 20 years of sobriety, because what they did after she got out of that rehab in Minneapolis is they made her go to a three-quarter house in Tampa, Florida, which, you know, she had no connection to Tampa, but that's what she needed. And she lived in a house with three other women and had to work the steps, sort of like, you know, what happens up here on the hill or some of the three-quarter houses that are around. So she finally got the program. Well, in the late 90s, my drinking was getting a little bit out of control, and it was causing some problems at home. And I remember my wife, finally saying, you need to go to an AA meeting. You need to try that. So she found one for me, thankfully. Yeah. She found one, and it was called the Howe Place. It's up in Woodstock off of Bells Ferry Road. And I remember trying to find this place, and there was a fire station. I had to ask at the fire station, where is this place? Because the GPS took me to the fire station, and sure enough, this AA place was right behind it. So that's the first time I remember going to an AA meeting for myself. And I started going on a sort of regular basis, but that was the beginning of my 10-year span of trying to do it my way. Because really, you shouldn't go to an AA meeting and then stop at the liquor store on your way home. It just doesn't work. But that's what I did for a while. But they said you needed to get a sponsor, and you should pick somebody that has something you want. And I remember this one guy was sharing one night, and he appeared to be about my age, and he talked about his boys who were about the same age as my kids. And I thought, well, okay. So I asked him if he would be my sponsor. And so, you know, I checked the block. I had a sponsor now. Well, I didn't really use him as a sponsor. We'd talk every now and then and whatever. But so things went rocking on and getting rockier, if you will. I remember my wife finally said, you need to go to Ridgeview. and she couldn't find it. I didn't want to go, but I let her get me in the car, and so she drove, and we ended up over by the old Bronner and didn't know where Ridgeview was, and I really didn't want to go to rehab. I was enjoying my drinking, or so I thought. And so when she stopped at Bronner to try to figure out where Ridgeview was, I got out and said, I'm not going. And I ended up calling a taxi. That back then you didn't have Uber, so I had to call a taxi and have them take me all the way back to Kennesaw. Well, that didn't go over very well. And so as it turns out, in around 2005, I came to Ridgeview. She, as Sam says, with a blowtorch at my butt, you know, I came to Ridgeview, not for me, but for her. And we did the Access Center on a Friday afternoon, and they said, okay, we'll have a bed available. Come back Monday morning. You'll start in the day program at the hospital, and you'll be living up in the men's recovery residence. Well, Monday morning came. I don't like peaches. I don't like brandy. But there really wasn't anything else in the house to drink. And I thought, you know what? I'm about to drive myself down to a rehab hospital. I might as well have several for the road. So I was drinking peach brandy on my way down here. You know, sort of like picking up a bottle at the liquor store after a meeting. Not the best thing to do. So I showed up at the Access Center Monday morning to be admitted to the program, and they smelt it, and they said, here, blow into this breathalyzer. And they said, oh, you can't go to the day hospital, you're going to have to go to Cottage C. And I'm thinking, okay, well, what's Cottage C? Well, I found out real quick. So I earned myself two nights in Cottage C until that peach brandy got out of my system. And then I came over here and I was doing the day hospital program, and unfortunately my insurance didn't cover it. It's funny, the Lockheed insurance would have covered a detox at that other hospital, Peachford, whatever. They would have done that, but not here. So I was on the self-pay plan and then staying up in the recovery residence. And I did that and graduated from the day program, went into the evening IOP, and then went back to work. And it didn't take long. I was back to drinking. And I remember I wrecked a car. Or a tree jumped out of the park in the parking lot, and I ran right into it, so I thought. And this was probably 6 or 9 months after I came through here the first time, so I refer to myself as a Ridgeview boomerang, because I got to come back a second time. And you talk about humbling is, well, this time I knew better. I did not drink anything on the way back. On the way coming down here, I showed up sober. But talk about humbling is when you walk through those doors, the same nurses are sitting at the nurse's station. You get assigned the same case manager you had previously. And then when you go to the evening IOP, you get the same case manager. But it was better the second time because I came for myself. But I remember calling up Ridgeview and saying, you know, I think I need to come back, and I don't want to go to, you know, cell block C. And they said, and the lady on the phone says, we call that Cottage C. And I said, you call whatever you want. I just remember I'm not going to cell block C. So that's one of the reasons I didn't drink on the way in. So I did. I came down and went through the program a second time. And I was also introduced to the idea that there is an alumni association that meets every Thursday. And I thought, you know what, maybe I need to do something different. I'm working just up the street. I get off at 3:30, 4 o'clock. So I said, you know, once I got done and with the day program and went to the evening IOP and started back working at Lockheed, I started coming back and spending Thursdays with Sam. And that seemed to be what I needed. I actually got some, I can't really use the word sobriety time, sober time, because unfortunately, I got to tell you, that was not the last white chip I picked up. And one of the things I realized during that period of time is I thought I had some short periods of sobriety. I didn't, because to have sobriety, I kept thinking I was relapsing after very short periods of time, but you know what? You can't relapse if you never have had sobriety. What I had was periods of interrupted drinking, because I might go a few weeks, a few months, or whatever, and I'm not drinking, but I'm white-knuckling it. My mind is doing nothing but thinking, oh, God, I want to drink. But I just, through sheer willpower, didn't take a drink. But only that worked for a little bit. And then I had gotten counseled by my supervisor at Lockheed. I guess he probably smelt it on me. And he said, you need to go and see the employee assistance program guy. You need to go talk to this man. His name is Randy. And I told him, I said, well, I don't need that. I am going to AA meetings. Yeah, I was, but I mean, I wasn't working the steps and all of that with a sponsor. So that got him off my case for a little while. But then at one point, and I'm not sure exactly when it was, my wife and the kids went to St. Louis for the weekend. So, okay, the cat's away, the mouse will play. And I showed up to work one morning while they were gone, thinking, you know, vodka doesn't smell. You know, how can they smell it? Because, you know, obviously I had to have a couple of hits before I left the house to drive into work at 6 in the morning. Well, I got news for you. I was working in an unair-conditioned hangar, and it was August. And when that stuff comes out of your pores, they can smell it. So I earned myself a week off without pay at Lockheed. And at that time, I was lucky enough. I had gotten to a point where I had an inside drive-in pass. So I had an automobile inside the fence. And so when they decided to walk me out, they had to drive me out in my own car. They said, you know, we'll drive. And then they called me a cab and sent me home. Well, what's the first thing I did? All right, I got another cab. And after I'd taken a few shots of vodka and came back to the parking lot at Lockheed and got my car, well, that really was a wake-up, or it should have been, because I ended up going and seeing, I mean, I had no choice now. I had to go see the EAP guy at Lockheed. And that was a really great thing, because he was a very knowledgeable person, and he helped me a lot. And I was only supposed to go see him maybe 6 or 8 sessions, but for months, I would go see him every other week. And, I mean, we really had a good rapport, and I learned a lot from him. And I was still working on that 10 years of interrupted drinking, because I still had a little bit more research to do. And I don't want to go into a whole lot more about that, but you would think that when I got a week off without pay from Lockheed, that would have been the eye-opener, and it really helped, but it wasn't total. I still had a little more research and development to do. And what finally got it, it was in 2008, my mother flew down from Boston to spend Christmas with me. And she also got to see her grandkids and my ex, you know, at their house. But I was still drinking some, and I thought I could sneak a drink or two while my mom was there. And you know what? You can't sneak a drink in front of an alcoholic. And like I said, at that time, she probably had 15 years of sobriety. You can't. And so I remember one day, right around Christmas time, that she sat down and we just had a heart-to-heart talk. And it's like nobody can talk to an alcoholic like another alcoholic. There was no yelling. There was no judgment. She just sort of laid out, you know, the fact that you got only a few more years at Lockheed, then you can take retirement. Because they told me after that one time when they walked me out, there would be no second chance. That was it. Next time was automatic termination. And so, you know, there I'm putting my retirement in jeopardy and everything else. So with mom's help, she helped me. Because, I mean, for years I admitted I was an alcoholic. I had no problem. I would admit that I was an alcoholic, but I didn't accept it up here and in here. And with her help, I had to accept the fact. And so I remember taking her back to the airport to Hartsfield to fly home on the 29th, and I went back to a meeting at lunchtime at the Howe place and picked up my last white chip. And another member of the alumni here was there, and he thought I was, you know, working on some sobriety at the time, and I thought he's going to fall out of the chair when I picked up another white chip. But that's what happened. And then I told my sponsor, I said, okay, now I'm serious. Let's start working the steps. And my sponsor is not what you call a Nazi sponsor. He's sort of going to let me control at the speed we do it, because as he said, it took him a couple years to get through the steps. So he was not one of these that we're going to do a step a week or a step a month or whatever. But I had to accept it and finally surrender. And when you start working the steps, all 12 of them, in the order they're in, not like an a la carte menu where you pick and choose which steps. You see, that's one of the things. I was a manufacturing engineer at Lockheed. I thought I was smarter than this. I thought I could get myself sober. And I can't. It's not an I program. It's a we program. So I finally had to submit to that. And with my sponsor's help, and the help of the suggestions of others, mostly the alumni here, I started on truly working the program. And I remember it had been a few months, and I thought to myself, wow, the only time I think about alcohol is when I'm in a meeting and we're talking about alcohol. And I ran over to my sponsor after the meeting. I said, and I told him that, and he says, yeah, I saw it before you could see it, that, you know, you were changing. And that in itself is one of the greatest benefits of this program, because like I said, during those periods of interrupted drinking, I was miserable. I was dry. As Sam says, I was tinder dry. I was about to self-combust. I was so dry. But I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy, joyous, and free, because I was just, that's, you know. But when you start working the program and the steps, because that's what the miracle comes from, is those steps. And they're in that order for a reason, to help you unload these things that have been, you know, the cause of your drinking. And so it really, I started getting some relief, you might say, because I was starting to be happy and not thinking about alcohol all the time. And so I'll never forget when I got to pick up my first blue chip, because that really, it just, you know, after 10 years of trying, and I kept thinking I was getting defective white chips, because, you know, and I'll admit, I didn't pick up a white chip every time I probably should have picked up a white chip, because I felt like I was a cost, hazard to the Howe place because they have to keep buying white chips, and I had enough to tile a bathroom. But and the other thing is I stayed active with the alumni. And that's part of my program today is Thursday nights down here. But so I started getting some sobriety, and after a while it got to the point where, as my sponsor says, that, you know, my sponsor tours with a 70s, 80s rock band. He does the merchandise, and so he's around alcohol and street drugs all the time. But he's got like 27 years of sobriety. He doesn't have to do it. He says sometimes he wants to throw some of the knuckleheads off the bus, but it's like they say, there's no place we can't go if we have a reason to be there and we're spiritually fit. I remember chairing a meeting with a friend of mine down in Atlanta, and we're on our way back. I'm taking him back to his house, and my then fiance calls me up and asks me if I want to meet her and a friend of hers who I'd never met and her boyfriend at a martini bar in Woodstock. I just come from chairing an AA meeting. I had a few years of sobriety. Yeah, I said, sure, I'll meet you there. And you know what? I was perfectly happy with my Diet Coke because they had good appetizers and food and there's good fellowship and stuff like that. And so it didn't bother me that the people at the table were drinking and I had a Diet Coke because the obsession to drink had been lifted. And if you work this program the way it's laid out, that'll happen to you. And it's just, like I said, I could be a poster child on how not to work the program of AA, because why I had to continue trying to do it my way for 10 years, I don't know. But you know what? It is what it is. I was divorced. My ex-wife did divorce me during that end of that 10-year period because, you know, she'd had enough of it. And I did get remarried almost 4 years ago. 2 weeks from now will be our fourth anniversary. And the person that I married, she is not one of us, but she hardly ever drinks. She might occasionally have a glass of wine or something like that. But if I had gotten sober with the same people that I came through Ridgeview, I probably would have never met her or whatever. So it is what it is, and I'm really happy. Oh, and one of the things I forgot, I had about 3 years of sobriety, and I was able to take early retirement from Lockheed. This is the promise that's coming true. I was able to take early retirement from Lockheed right after I turned age 55, so that to me was one promise, because I would not have retired if I was still, you know, out there, because there was a little bit of accountability. The second one is that I met Beth, my current wife, and I remember the first time we both had plenty of fish accounts, and we met at a restaurant in Woodstock. And I was up front with her the very first meeting, and I told her I'm a recovering alcoholic, but I got about 3 years of sobriety. And she had to get out of a marriage because of addiction problems, and so she said she would never get mixed up with somebody that had an addiction or an alcohol problem, but she gave me a chance. And like I said, that was about 6 years ago, and we've been married now for about four. And the third was, I thought, you know what, I would love to go back to flying, because I quit flying while I was working at Lockheed. And I used to tell everybody, well, you know, I have a family I'm raising, I've got a career, and this, that, and the other, and that's why I quit flying. It wasn't that. I mean, after a few years of sobriety, you start to look back at what you've done in your life, and I realize I quit flying because it would have interfered with my drinking. And so all of a sudden I decided I'm going to try it again. And so I fill out this form to get a medical certificate. And they say, have you ever had any issues with alcohol or drugs? And I told them, yes, I'm a recovering alcoholic with 3 years of sobriety. I thought they were going to pat me on the back. Hell no. I finally got a letter, which another member of this alumni helped get me down off the ceiling because I was so mad when I read this. I had to go to a psychologist to have a whole battery of intelligence testing. I guess they want to make sure I didn't, you know, destroy my brain. I had to see a psychiatrist and tell him all about my, you know, program of AA and stuff like that. And I had to get a letter from Sam, and Sam had to write me a letter once a year for the next 3 years. But so when I completed all of the tasks the FAA said I had to do, they then issued me a medical certificate, and I was able to re-earn my pilot's license. And that's something I love. I really absolutely love flying. And it's just private, you know, a little single-engine airplane, but I like to go up and, you know, punch holes in the clouds. And it's a lot of fun. Like I said, ever since a kid, that's aviation's been in my blood. My father was the same way. He was a pilot. And so those are the three promises that came true. And I continue to stay sober and work the program. I have two meetings a week that are my musts that I do, and my wife understands. I'm going to go to those two meetings and Thursday night down here with the alumni. Those are the three things I do because I don't want to, as I love the saying, I don't want to come back into Ridgeview, so I come back to Ridgeview on a weekly basis to prevent having to go back to, you know, cell block C. But I volunteer down here during the family workshop, which is next week, and Beth and I are going on a cruise, so I'm not going to be here because we're going to celebrate our fourth anniversary. But so I feel like I stand up at this podium because I normally do the welcome announcements. But one of the things I tell everybody on the last day of the family workshop is, and I want to just say it to all of you here, is for the family members or, you know, significant others, those of you that have an alcoholic or an addict in your life, I would recommend you try the Al-Anon, Alateen, or Naranon meetings that are available. And it's not to help you better understand the addict or alcoholic in your life. It's your program to help you get better, because let's face it, those of us that had the addiction, we've caused a lot of turmoil. We have a program. We have our Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. We have a meeting program. We have sponsors. That's what the Al-Anon meetings are for the family members. I've heard a lot of people say they don't like them. And, you know, if you've never tried one, I'd say give it an hour just to see, because that way, just like our program, it's not an I program, it's a we program. I would just recommend you give it a try and see, because that helps you to recover from the turmoil and the damage that we alcoholics, addicts, have brought into your life. And the other thing is, for the patients and the alcoholics that are sitting in here that have not come down on Thursday, please come down and see what the alumni steering committee is all about on Thursday nights. We have the steering committee meeting, which is a business meeting, at 5:45 down at Pro North. And then at 6:30 is the aftercare program with Sam. So, I mean, those, my two meetings and this Thursday is what's helped me.
I can't believe it. Come December, I'm going to have 10 years. So I'm going to have as many years of sobriety as I did of trying to do it my way. So it's, like I said, it's a we program. And we together can stay sober and get sober. And I feel like now I'm just flapping my lips and my mouth is dry. So I want to thank you for letting me come down here and stay sober one day at a time. It's great.
Thank you, John. I've known you all those 10 years, but that's the first time I've had an opportunity to hear your story.